Absolutely. It's not a radical thing for the decision makers to do today. It's based on people hearing from our system working and people communicating that are informed, intelligent people that are leaders of the communities. And so, yes, it's really thrilling. It's like the many hands together can actually become a pretty harmonic voice. And I think and we as elected officials have heard from so many more of our constituents that haven't necessarily called the governor's office. So we're just representing our communities ourselves as a city councilor. So in a sense, those numbers are kind of exponential beyond the 86.
Wow. So we've seen a groundswell of support and now this denial of the permit for the Amber Energy proposed Morro Pacific coal export project. Again, I've been speaking with Arlene Burns. She is the president of the Mosier City Council in Oregon. Thank you so much for joining us today, Arlene Burns, on the KBOO Evening News.
All right. And thanks for calling.
This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO Radio.
KBOO is getting ready for our annual book and record sale coming soon, and we are accepting donations now. The sale will be held sometime this fall. The book and record sale is a great way to help contribute to your community. So do us and yourself a favor. Clear out those books, comics, DVDs, VHS tapes, LPs, and CDs collecting dust around your abode and bring them down to the station, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, during our business hours. Got questions? Contact Jesse at 503-231-8032, extension 213, or online via email, volunteer@kboo.org. Remember, the stuff that you're sick of, others may treasure. Turn your clutter into cash for your community radio station, KBOO.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Hello, everyone. The time is now 6:01 p.m. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. This is Labor Radio. I'm your host, Nick Bubb, and we've got a very exciting show for you tonight. Coming up a little bit later, we got some folks from NATCA, that's the National Air Traffic Controllers. And first up, we've got Fred Smith, who's going to talk to us about multi-employer pension plan reform. I'm assuming some of you out there listening to the show right now would like to retire someday, so listen up. This is really important stuff. Fred, how are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you for having me here tonight, Nick. I'm a retired member of the UA 290, the Plumbers and Steam Fitters Local here in Portland. I started working as a ship fitting apprentice back in New England in the late 1960s. After moving to the Pacific Northwest, I worked as a machinist in the shipyards and various truck shops in the area. I switched jobs to pipe fitting about 15 years ago. I was born in 1946, which means I'm on the leading edge of the baby boomer generation. Throughout my whole life, I've always been told that if I work hard and save my money, I would be comfortable in retirement. The three-legged stool of savings, pensions, and Social Security would finance that comfort. I've done all that. I've contributed to four different pension plans, all of which are multi-employer plans. It is the imminent danger to these multi-employer plans that is my topic here tonight. Let me begin with the acknowledgement that less than 50% of the population have no pensions plans at all. They will survive on the meager benefits paid out by Social Security. This is flat out wrong. Mm-hmm. Social Security does not pay enough benefits to live on comfortably. That said, there are two major types of retirement plans, the defined benefit plans and the defined contribution plans. The defined benefit plans, contribution plans define how much money will be put in the plan by the employers. The defined benefit plan says how much money you will get out of the plan. There are several types of defined contribution plans. Most common of those are the 401ks and the IRAs. A defined benefit plan falls into two categories, the multi-employer plan and the single employer plan. Currently, there are about 10 million people in multi-employer plans that cover occupations such as longshore, trucking, mechanics, food and commercial workers, the TV and film people, and many, many more. There are another 35 million people in single employer plans who largely work for the government or at least a single company. It is the 10 million workers in the multi-employer plans that are in extreme danger today, but this danger can quickly spread to the single employer plans.
Mm-hmm.
Defined benefit plans were once the predominant choice for pension plans. Union and non-union companies created these plans partially to keep good employees and reduce turnover. They pay better benefits than defined contribution plans and are much more stable. The current problems with the defined benefit plans are all related to the fraudulent practices of the bankers that brought about the 2007 housing market crash and subsequent worldwide economic collapse. Millions of people lost their homes. Millions more lost their jobs or were forced into early retirement. Pension plans became unfunded as stocks declined. Millions more saw their paychecks cut and their living standards drop. The attack on pensions is just another part of today's wealth transfer from the middle class to the Wall Street investors. Asset prices have since risen and returned most of all the pension plans to a reasonable funding level. Some plans, though, are still in deep trouble, and that has led to the crisis that we see today. The bankruptcy of Studebaker Automobiles led to the passage of the Employment Retirement Stabilization Act of 1974, commonly known as ERISA. ERISA also established the Pension Guarantee Trust Corporation to create some type of insurance plan to make sure that the retirees would still have something to live on should any defined benefit pension plan fail. The PBGC does not have the full backing of the U.S. government. Its revenue sources come from four sources. One, investments. Two, assets from failed plans. Three, insurance premiums, which are set very low by Congress, who also sets the benefits. And four, the recovery of unfunded liabilities of bankrupt plans. The PBGC itself is expected to run out of money to pay benefits within the next 10 to 15 years. The National Coordinating Committee for the Multi-Employer Plans, the NCCMP, was established alongside of ERISA so that the financial planners, employers, and unions could jointly advise Congress as to any changes to the ERISA laws that need to be written. Various changes to the ERISA laws are made when the law sunsets. The law has sunset numerous times and is to do so again by the end of this year. In the 1980s, an employer's withdrawal liability was added to prevent employers from leaving the plan while owing money for those promised benefits. One of the central tenets of the ERISA law is known as the anti-cutback rule, which states that promised pension benefits will be paid out as long as there remains money in the plan to do so. The anti-cutback rule has been in place since ERISA began some 40 years ago. The NCCMP today is proposing that Congress change fundamental provisions of the ERISA law to 1. Raise retirement age for collecting pension benefits to 67, 2. End employer withdrawal liabilities, 3. Allow the financial planning industry to, quote, intervene early to better manage the plans to prevent default, unquote. This would be done by reducing the defined benefits, which in no case would be reduced anywhere below 110% of what the PBGC benefits guarantee. In essence, the defined benefit plans would no longer define what benefit it would pay to retirees. Benefits would now be paid on a sliding scale. Another proposal by the NCCMP eliminates the defined benefit plans completely and replaces them with a quote, hybrid plan, unquote. A few improvements would make it a little bit better than the normal defined contribution type plans. Investments would be more conservative with a rate of return of 3-4% instead of the current expected rate of 6.5-7%. When Previously, the NCCMP stated the defined benefit plans are the only reliable mechanism to ensure lifetime income protection. They now call for the only reliable mechanism to be replaced. The NCCMP has been meeting and lobbying Congress to change ERISA for a couple of years now, mostly behind the backs of the plan participants. The problems are real. Two failing pension plans are headed for insolvency that would add $24 billion in debts to the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. The Teamster Central States Plan, which includes the Southeast and Southwest areas, and the United Mine Workers of America would add 528,000 retirees, a half a million people, to the 1.5 million that the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation currently pays benefits for. The present mood in Congress is against any bailouts for the pension system. This is reflected in naming the NCCMP document that supports these changes. It is called Solutions Not Bailouts, a comprehensive plan from business and labor to protect taxpayers and spur economic development. Having bailed out the bankers that created this mess, financed several wars to the tune of $2 trillion and pumped trillions more into the economy through qualitative easing, we are told that there is no money left for pensions. The NCCMP accepts this answer and passes on the cost to the pensioners. No one is to blame for the crisis, not the bankers, not Congress, not the unions, not the employers, not the planners that made the investment decisions. No one. They all want to simply turn the page and accept the new normal. What will they propose after the next economic bubble burst? Without withdrawal liabilities, why should the employers not join the companies that have dumped their defined benefit pension plans in favor of defined contribution plans? Why have all the plan trustees, fiduciaries, and unions remained silent on this unfolding crisis? Why have the retirees been kept in the dark on the changes that could well impact their future? Why should we trust and allow the people that created this mess to become the principal architects of the plans to solve it?
Fred, if you can hold your spot there for just a second. For the people at home that don't understand what you just said there, that aren't really sure what all this means. Basically, what I'm understanding here is the people that worked all their lives, that broke their backs and broke their bodies for their companies so that they could provide for themselves and their families, the benefits that they were promised in return for that are instead being transferred to the people that already have most of the money in this country. The companies, the corporations, those people are not being required under this new proposal, they're not being required to pay out what they promised their workers. Instead, they're expecting the workers just to accept and live with less. Is that what I'm hearing?
That's pretty much what you're hearing. And the surprising thing about this is the fact that the unions, or at least a very large amount of the unions, are supporting this proposal.
But it's the actual union leadership and the trustees that are responsible for some of these accounts. Is it fair to say that most of the people that are rank and file in the unions, most of the people that are expecting these pensions, aren't really informed in this process? They don't know what's going on behind their backs.
They have absolutely no clue as to what's going on. These changes to the laws are going to be presented to us as a fait accompli, and people are going to be scratching their head and said, what happened? But this is going to come up, and it's going to come up soon.
Yeah, you said that these laws are sunsetting at the end of the year. That's just 4 months away. I mean, what can people do? Do you have to get on the horn immediately with your congressman? Do you have to send out emails and phone calls? Or is this something that do we write to our union leadership?
I would say all of that. I don't know whether writing congressmen is going to be much of a solution. The Congress is already wants to get rid of these things. They're not really very favorable to labor for the most part. Certainly speaking to your unions and letting them know that you're opposed to this would be good, because, like I say, there are many unions that support it, probably not so much on the local level as on the national level. And they have to be made aware that the people aren't going to put up with it. There's a lot of people that should lose their jobs.
That's right, and well, they should. I know that we've done a good job in our local pension at Local 290. That thing's funded, and I'll still get some kind of benefits out of that. But the national pension, when looking at that thing, I'm actually, as it is, promised less benefits than the amount of money that I'm paying in. And that's not including any kind of investments that they're going to be getting off that. And they're talking about cutting it to even less, maybe, and letting these employers off with no liability. That's not right.
There are a lot of union pension plans that are in deep economic trouble. The worst example of which would be the Central States Teamster Plan. They have about 420,000 people in both the Central Plan, the Southeast Plan, and Southwest Plan, and they don't have the money to pay the benefits for them. Another one that's in deep trouble is the United Mine Workers of America. And I can't blame the unions for all of these problems that they're having, because particularly with the United Mine Workers, the situation that they had at Patriot Coal, the companies are finding ways to switch their pension plans onto different companies and then allowing those other companies to go bankrupt. And so, therefore, the pension plan goes bankrupt with it.
Oh, that's sneaky right there. Yeah, that shouldn't be allowed at all. I mean, people worked hard for their pensions. They should get what they were promised. I mean, that's the way that I see it, cut and dry. Now, I heard you mention in there that they want to lower the limit so that it will not go below 110% of the Pension Benefits Guarantee Corporation. But 110% of that level is already really low, right?
It is low, and the amount that is paid out by the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation differs considerably if you're in a single employer plan or whether you're in a multi-employer plan. I don't have the figures exactly right now, but it's roughly the maximum amount that you could get for a single employer plan would be about $54,000 a year, which is a fairly good pension.
Mm-hmm.
The multi-employer plans maxes out somewhere a little over $11,000.
Wow, that's really low. That's a big deal. Why is the difference so big on that? Have they said?
Well, yeah. The reason is the multi-employer plans were originally thought to be extremely stable. For the first probably 30 years of these plans, they didn't have any pension premium at all that was paid into the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation.
Hmm.
The single employer plans pay, I think it's gone up to about $14 a year for insurance, and then they pay so much per $1,000 of unfunded, thank you, liabilities that they have. The single employer plans were thought to be so secure because they had, if one of their plans failed, they would have a whole bunch of other ones that would take over, and they would pay into the benefits. But as more and more plans have ended in the single, the multi-employer pension plans, the employers have forced out these plans and turned them into defined contribution plans, which have no protections whatsoever.
Right.
So as more and more people leave these plans, the whole structure of the multi-employer defined benefit plans becomes sketchy and endangered.
You know, for everyone out there right now, I'm sure you have a good idea if you're in a multi-employer plan or a single employer plan, but you probably don't have any idea the status of your pension, where it's funded at. Unless you're close to retirement and you go to the meetings, maybe you don't know. But this is a wake-up call. You need to get in there and find out exactly what it is that's going on with your pension, because if these changes go in and you're in a multi-employer plan and there's no termination of the plan liability on any given employer and they leave, that puts the burden to fund that on all the remaining employers. And if they leave too, pretty soon there's nothing left and you're going to get an extremely reduced pension amount. And 110% of the PBGC amount is very low.
It's interesting how they do that too. Is they have come up with a figure higher than the PBGC, which makes it look like it's a good thing. But what actually happens is that the financial planners end up by maintaining that plan and using your money and taking that money for management fees rather than giving it over to the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. So that if they ever do run out of money and this thing does go over to the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, they won't have any money to use to pay off the benefits.
All right. Well, that's me getting off my soapbox for the pension reform. Fred, thanks so much for coming down. Take this to heart, everyone, and talk to your union leadership, because now's the time that you can still make a difference. 4 months from now, when the current law is sunset, you don't want to find out that you could have made a difference, but then it's too late. So I've also got Kyle in here. He is with, well, actually, Kyle, I'll let you tell everyone. Who are you with?
Hi, my name's Kyle Johnson. I'm with the National Air Traffic Controllers Association, assigned here to work on the Labor 2000 campaign in the state of Oregon. I'm here with my partner, Chris McKeever from Seattle. I'm up from San Francisco. We're both retired air traffic controllers, and for folks who don't really know anything about air traffic control, President Reagan fired 15,000 air traffic controllers in 1981. Out of those ashes became the National Air Traffic Controllers Association, which I'm proud to say that I was in the beginning stages of NATCA, a charter member, a retired lifetime member of the organization, and assigned here with the Oregon AFL-CIO to get the word out for the candidates that should be supportive of labor. Little background on me: I grew up in Southern Ohio. I come from a union background. My father was a laborer. My grandfather was a coal mine worker. My brother's a steel worker, and I've got a son who is a insulator. I'm trying to talk my youngest son, who's a professional ball player, into organizing the independent leagues of some independent baseball leagues. That's my drop for that. Go Vallejo Admirals. Ballots drop. What we want to get across to our members is basically is we want to make sure all of our members are registered to vote. Every day, Chris and I are out on the job sites doing work site visits, dropping off information about why you should register and how you should register. Question about why you should register, because when union members vote and workers vote, we usually win. Who can vote? If you're an American citizen in the state of Oregon, regardless of any past criminal convictions you may have had, you are eligible to vote. If you are walking the streets in the state of Oregon, you are eligible to vote.
And that means, like, pretty much no matter what they've been convicted of, no matter what they've done, if they've served their time and they're out on the streets, they're free men.
Or women,
right.
That's correct.
Then they can vote.
That is correct. And we want to get that across to all of our members, that is your right, and exercise your right, your franchise.
But it's not like that in all states, is it?
No, actually, Oregon is very, very liberal. We can only come up with one other state that has a equally liberal policy, and that, we believe, is the state of Alaska. It's very easy. If you're newly moved here to work, you can register. If you need to figure out how to register, you can go to your local union, or you can call the Oregon AFL-CIO office at 503-232-1195 and ask for information about voting. That will help you, and we'll do our part to get you registered.
So here's something that might affect anyone that does have a history in the past, you know, something they've done maybe last week or many, 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 many years ago. Maybe right out of high school. What's coming up that could change their lives as far as labor goes?
Well, this is a very important election. There's a lot of entrenched money interest putting a lot of money into this election to upset some candidates. We are here from NATCA and from the Air Traffic Controllers Union, especially to support Jeff Merkley, Earl Blumenauer, and the governor. We support candidates who support working men and women, who have been in our corner from the beginning, who will fight with us to the end. Senator Merkley has been a friend of ours. He has sponsored legislation, especially for air traffic. He's been co-sponsored to legislation on the sequestration that happened when they did the government shutdown and they tried to lay off controllers. He helped fight that fight for us to keep our folks working and keeping the system safe and flying. He's co-sponsored bills for new manufacturing jobs. He's helped bring jobs back to America for his legislation on bringing jobs back to America, and he's worked on stopping legislation that rewards companies for shipping jobs offshore. Those are the candidates we support. Those are the folks that we're here for and that we will fight for every day. We're trying to get the word out to our members, whether you be an iron worker, whether you be a UA member, whether you be I get my dig in. My brother over here is a machinist. We're here to fight for you every day, and we're out there. You'll see us on the job sites in the mornings. Take our flyers, listen to our message. All we're trying to do is to get the information out.
So one of the things that that actually affects people's lives when they're applying for work is a little box on the application that says, "Have you ever been convicted of a crime?" And if you have to check that box, a lot of times they're just going to throw that application right out. When you've got 1,500 applications to fill a job, you got to weed those out somehow, and I suspect that those are probably the first applications to go. What kind of help can we get these people? Their lives are changed. They're out. They want to support their family. They want to support themselves. They don't want to be a drain on America. This is what people will label them as, and oftentimes, most of the time, that's not the case at all. What's coming up that can help these guys?
Well, with organized labor and through the AFL-CIO, we've been working with a group of folks working on it, which is called Ban the Box. It's a petition that does away with the box on an initial interview that describes, one of the first questions that's asked on an initial interview is, have you ever been convicted? Well, if you have to check that box, whether you've done your time or whatever, you check that box, your application has about a 6% chance of getting through the process. What we're trying to do is to stop that from the initial interview. Background checks will still be conducted for jobs that are sensitive, and background jobs or support would be there. But what we're trying to do is to ban that box from the beginning, and so that people aren't stigmatized with the box right from the beginning. And if you get into a little bit longer into the interview, you might find out that this is a guy that you want or a woman that you would want living in your condominium, or someone that you would want to hire with their background. I'm a veteran. I'm an old Vietnam guy, and we find that a lot of our folks get discriminated against. Ex-military guys come back from the war, may have some issues with some PTSD issues.
PTSD
issues that may have gotten caught up in some criminal activity at one time or another. But they shouldn't be banned for life to be able to rent apartments or to have employment. So to ban the box is basically about removing it from the initial contact. It's fair chance for all. You'll see folks petitioning your neighborhood. Please sign on to that petition, fair chance for all. Give everybody a chance to who have paid their debts to society to get their chance back. We talked about that a little bit earlier in the franchising of folks for their voting rights. We feel the same way about employment and for housing.
That's right, and this is really a chance to make a difference. I got to tell you guys, I'm on jury duty right now. I got put on the grand jury, and I can't talk about any cases, but what I can tell you is that a lot of these charges that come through, they trump them up. I mean, you kind of get a sense maybe somebody was involved in something wrong, but they trump the charges up so far above and beyond anything that the person did. And then how they justify it is they tell us, well, what's going to happen is this will put pressure on them to make a plea bargain. So in change, because they're scared, because all these charges are piled on them, they'll plead guilty to something that they maybe, they don't even really feel guilty of, but they're just scared. And then what they don't realize is for the rest of their lives, this is going to follow them. And so a fair chance for all by banning that box from the beginning, they still get to disclose it to the employer by the end, but they're not initially disqualified just for having that checked. And that really, this is a labor movement, you guys, because this affects working people every day.
Absolutely. One big thing I wanted to impress on everybody, Oregon's different because we have mail-in ballots here. Ballots drop on the 14th. Make sure you get your ballot. Make sure you're registered to vote. Make sure that you've done all the things. You've got your information to you. If there's any information out there that you're looking for, call your local union, call the AFL-CIO here in Portland, get the information you need to be an informed voter and exercise your franchise to vote.
So I got a question for you. In regards to minimum wage, there's been a huge movement to get a $15 minimum wage. Seattle passed it. There's a movement in Portland, but Oregon's more restrictive. They won't let a city just increase the minimum wage by themselves. Who do you know that's trying to increase the minimum wage nationally?
Well, on a national level, I know that Senator Merkley is behind the he's. I don't know that he has co-sponsored the legislation, but I know that he is in favor of that legislation. I can only talk about the folks that we deal with here in Oregon. As far as That's the rest right. of the national side of it, I know that the that it's easy to figure out by looking at the voting record of the folks in your district who stands for working people and who don't. It's very easy. The AFL-CIO has more information on this. We can get you that information if you need it. But I will tell you that if you go into the congressional record and look at who voted for minimum wage legislation that was up this last cycle, folks who voted to privatize Social Security and Medicare, folks who are anti-workers' rights, that information is easily gleaned from the website on the national websites.
Well, that's just about all the time we have tonight. As much as I would love to talk about this stuff for another hour with you guys, I want to say a special thanks to Fred Smith for coming down to educate us on the pension reforms that are going on. And I want to thank Kyle from NATCA and Chris also, who's not in front of a microphone right now. You guys are doing a great job. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us, Nick.
Have a good night, everyone.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you,